This is the Mason Vera Payne Show, your go-to lifestyle program, covering everything from technology and gaming to movies, TV shows, and pop culture to the supernatural and beyond. Brought to you by WGNRadio.com with your host, the unabridged millennial, Mason Vera Payne.
This is Mason Vera Payne, live from the MVP studios in Chicago, and thanks for tuning in. Bartending, being a butcher, or even a barber, it's not a lowbrow career choice anymore. These type of craft jobs are not only in high demand, but they're also high paying. Joining me to elaborate on craft jobs and how they blossomed is author of Masters of Craft, Old Jobs and the New Urban Economy, Richard Osijo. Thanks for joining me, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
Could you tell me a little bit about your book? Because it's mainly about crafts, but how did you get into that?
Well, I was conducting research in downtown Manhattan, specifically in its large nightlife scene. It was for this other project I was working on gentrification and urban change. And as part of that, I was hanging out at a lot of these special craft cocktail bars. And I really just kind of fell in love with it and decided to turn it into a little side project. And I just kind of kept going back, and I just learned more and more about this cultural movement that was going on that was based on reviving this lost practice and this lost culture of craft cocktails that were made in the U.S. in the 19th century and early 20th century. And from there, I just kind of kept finding similar examples of different old jobs that are being revived today, that are coming back, that are becoming more craft-based after a long period of being relatively unskilled and low status. So from the cocktail bartenders who I met, I started studying craft distillers. Then I looked at upscale men's barbers. And then I finally looked at whole animal butchers and butcher shop workers. And they were all related to each other in many ways. They were all old traditional jobs. They were all relatively low status jobs today. And they were all being revived and revived around this sense of craft and craftsmanship in the work they were doing. That's how I came to study it.
Man, that sounds like a lot of fun, the night scene one, because I think I'd have a lot of fun trying out those cocktails.
Yeah, it was. It was a lot of fun. All of it was a lot of fun, but yeah, that was a cool part of it, yeah.
No, I was. I read through one of the chapters, and forgive me, I forget which chapter it was, but there was a whole thing about gin, and there was this gin scene. And I was just like, there's a scene for gin. You know, to me, it's just a drink.
That's a very, very big part of the cocktail world in the U.S., but also really around the world. Gin's a very popular category and a growing category in many parts of the world. And that part of the book is when I was really trying to show some of the debates that go on within these communities that I looked at, these occupational communities, over what is considered to be good or what is considered to be quality or even what gets to be called gin. So in that case, they were arguing over whether some of the new gins that are on the market should be called gins or whether they should be called something else because they didn't resemble the more traditional and conventional types of gin that we've usually seen in liquor stores. So yeah, no, for them, for most of us, it's just a drink, but for these folks, it's a very, very important way that they try to define themselves and to figure out what their identities are as professionals in these communities.
You know, in the past couple of years, people talk about hipsters and the things going mainstream. Do you think that this, because it goes mainstream, that it'll eventually fizzle out? Or is this going to be something that's going to be part of our economy?
Well, I think it's always going to have two dimensions to it. I think it is becoming mainstream in its way. We see supermarkets now that have organic food sections, for instance. That's very much related to what I've studied. We see supermarkets that have meat counters with local meat. We see restaurants and even just regular neighborhood bars that have cocktail menus now, or even craft beer. I didn't study craft brewers, but I certainly could have. They're certainly part of this phenomena that I'm looking at. So we are seeing how elements of these worlds are being mainstreamed or are becoming more and more common. But at the same time, the grassroots core of them is still very niche, is still very small. So while you can, chances are you can get a decent enough cocktail in more places now than you used to be able to, craft cocktail bars done in a very, very specific, almost painstaking way are still relatively rare outside of large cities and pretty much outside of cool, gentrifying neighborhoods in those cities at that. So I think that's going to continue for a while, that we're going to see, you know, different elements, different versions, I guess, of these occupations and their products and services in more and more places. But they're not going to always resemble perfectly what they were like when they first got created and when they first emerged in some of the smaller, more grassroots, on the ground places. And I think those will still continue for people who are interested in that, you know, far more specialized and rarefied version of them.
For the people who you spoke with, when they started these, like, I guess, careers into this craft world, was it because it was a hobby at first, or was this a necessity because they needed a job?
Well, that's really interesting you bring that up, because for some of them, there was a little bit of that cultural hobbyist, I guess, or just cultural interest, but not for many, really not for many. There wasn't, I only met one craft distiller who had ever distilled before, for instance. But for most of them, they needed a job, but really what they were doing was they were pursuing something that they had some kind of interest in. You know, they wanted to do something that was kind of, that was meaningful, that was fulfilling, something that they had some kind of passion for. So that could have been, say, in the case of the butchers, many of them were interested in food in general, right? They were interested in something about the food industry. They were critical of the food industry, or specifically of the meat industry, and they didn't really find that same passion in other areas of the economy. They eventually gravitated towards something like a specialized whole animal butcher shop. Or for the bartenders, they eventually discovered that they really liked the creativity and the ideas and the knowledge behind cocktails. Not that it was something that they were necessarily hobbyists or practicing at home, but they may have bartended before, and they eventually discovered that there were these unique bars where they weren't just serving drinks, but they were being creative and they were interacting with people in a very meaningful and educational way, and they could really kind of make a career out of it. So I kind of expected to find more people who were home bartenders and geeks about cocktails and for the barbers, be it men's fashion or even barbering and classic barber shops, or for the butchers, people who were, you know, say like home cooks or something like that, and some were. But for the most part, it was people who, yep, they needed to have a job, but more specifically, they wanted a job that had some kind of purpose in their lives. And eventually they discovered these industries.
For some of these industries, I'm thinking, and correct me if I'm wrong, like the butcher one, and maybe a little bit into the barbers, some of this stuff you can't learn in school. Like, you have to actually apply it. Do you think that in the future, maybe in 5 years, that we're going to see apprenticeships?
Well, they do have them. They do exist in these businesses to a certain extent. The barbering is interesting because you need to be licensed for it. It's the only one of the four that you need a state license to get. So you have to pass an exam and everything, and typically you do that in a school. So you have to go through an accredited school, and you take the exam, and then you get your barber's license. But you can also apprentice under what's called a master barber, and that counts as your instruction, and then you have to pass the test. And we are seeing some of these barbershops that are starting, that are doing that. The one that I focused on has done that before. They don't have a school-like system, a formal system set up or anything like that, but they have trained many barbers who are still working there or who have gone on to other places or opened up their own shops through that more master-apprentice system. And, you know, the butchers have done it in a very similar way. They all have, and to certain extents, had some kind of apprentice or internship type system. And I think it's an open question whether we're going to see formal educational institutions and programs catch up to that and try to model it and mimic it and start to formally train some of these workers in these more specific versions of these jobs. I guess we'll see. I think it's an open question, but there is already a bit of a foundation being laid for through these informal relationships and programs that these businesses have already.
Do you think that signs that people want to buy these services, because these aren't cheap, you know, the butchers and all their meat, it's going to be very expensive, more so than, you know, the regular stuff you find at Walmart. Do you think that this is a sign that the economy is kind of getting better? Like, oh, people are willing to drop $100 or $150 to go to the barber. You know, do you think it's getting better now? Or is this just an experience that people want?
Well, I think it is probably a little bit of a combination. I think it also speaks to where these businesses are open. They tend to be open in the, I guess we can call them the successful parts of cities, which are the successful cities in successful regions. So regions that were not hit as hard, I suppose, during the most recent economic downturn almost a decade ago now. It's in neighborhoods in cities that are attracting well-educated, high-income earners, or at least earners who have disposable income, mostly young, well-educated folks. So seeing these specific places as some kind of bellwether for the economy is probably a bit misleading, simply because they're, you know, working in places that are relatively rebounding, that have more or less rebounded from the recession. They are more expensive products, for sure. I happen to be, but inexperience plays a big role in why they're expensive and why people are willing to pay for it. I was studying the bartenders just as the recession was going on, and they didn't really cite any effects, not tremendous effects, from the downturn, perhaps a little bit. Then again, I was also studying New York City, which did not get hit in terms of, say, the housing market issue, did not get hit as hard as some other parts of the country, primarily because New York City is 70% renters and only about 30% homeowners. I'm sure that was a big factor in it. But yeah, I think there's been some studies on whether luxury goods have a downturn alongside the economy, and I think the results are usually pretty mixed. Some do, some don't. And you know, in these cases, for the most part, they didn't, but I'm sure there's some data that would show that there was perhaps a bit of a slowdown during that period in terms of opening a business. It was probably more difficult to open a business then. But yeah, I don't think that it didn't have any major impact, and they've recovered. But then again, a lot of New York City, where these businesses are open, have recovered. So, and that's the case for a lot of other cities where you see these large scenes like San Francisco, Chicago, Los Angeles, Boston, right? These are all cities that have more or less bounced back post-recession.
For those who are listening and that are interested in your book, where can they find it at?
Well, you can find it hopefully at your local bookstore, but if you cannot find it there, you can go on to the Princeton University Press website, or of course you can also go on to Amazon and you'll find it there.
This has been the Mason Vera Payne Show. Thanks for listening. Can't wait to hear more? Subscribe, rate, and comment at masonverapayne.com. That's masonverapayne.com. Also, follow Mason on Facebook and Twitter at Mason Vera Payne. That's all one word. And don't forget to share the show with your friends.